for example, they kind of they default to things like, well, we're, you know, we're really only required to provide 10 to 12 hours per week of programming, and we really can't provide services in community-based settings very easily because it means we have to travel to additional places. So it kind of just, particularly the larger, bigger urban districts tend to, tend to do what they have to do. And that's where, you know, they kind of meet this low bar, but I don't think, and I don't want to suggest that they don't care about families' needs, but I think sometimes they get kind of callous and a little bit like they lose sight sometimes of what it really means to meet a family's or a child's needs as opposed to just doing like what they've always done or something.
Heidi, what do you think districts or schools would do if there weren't financial barriers or things like that? What would they implement if that was no longer a barrier?
I think it varies some, but, and it isn't that finances aren't a barrier, but I honestly think that maybe mindset is a bigger barrier sometimes to how they use their resources than the resources themselves. And it has to do with things like personnel who work across the system. So related services personnel in our state are licensed from birth to 21. And so, you know, it might be that an OT or an PT is working with preschoolers as well as kids in middle school and high school. And they just tend to kind of apply the same strategies across the board. So I think some of it for me has to do with individualization and so maybe capacity in a whole variety of ways. I don't feel like I'm doing a great job in like dialing into some of your questions. I hope I'm not deflecting a lot.
When you think about those aspects of high quality inclusion, you mentioned ratio, I think, and a couple other, but what would be three elements that come to mind? Or a couple.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it really has more to do with how a child is being engaged than where they are. I mean, I do want them in blended classrooms, but if they're in a blended classroom and they're not getting individualized instruction, or they're not working on things that actually support their access to the general ed curriculum and to peers, then I mean, that's as important, maybe more important, I dare say, than the fact that they're in a blended classroom. I think, for me, another element really has to do with kind of this notion of family engagement. So in terms of informing the placement decision, being a true member of the team, helping identify the family, the goals from a family priority perspective, not just, you know, from a kind of teaching and classroom perspective. thinking about peer engagement and kind of peers as interventionists, if you will. Really, I guess for me, another piece that I'm somewhat concerned about really has to do with the role of the general ed teacher and their capacity for thinking about and supporting kind of engagement and participation for all children in their classroom, and not thinking about kiddos on IEPs as like someone else's kid. I think we have, there's a lot of local autonomy in Colorado, and so you know, we have some systems where an early childhood special educator who's licensed is the classroom teacher. But we have a lot of places where a gen ed teacher who's kind of minimally qualified is the kind of teacher of record. And there might be a 30-minute a week or something early childhood special educator coming in to provide, quote, direct services for a child, but may not really be supporting that general ed teacher to ensure that kiddo has really access to the things that are occurring within the daily routine in the classroom. So maybe as I'm talking, I'm thinking, you know, maybe what we mostly measure right now are structural elements of inclusion. But maybe what I care about more has it really to do with the quality of instruction and the quality of service delivery, I guess you could say, and how much that aligns with kind of the child and family's needs and desires. I'm not sure how that gets measured exactly. We don't really measure that now.
If Dr. Strain or Mr. Strain, Bill Strain, came to you and said, I can answer three questions for you with this study. Let's just say one. If there's one wondering or curiosity, how would you answer that if he asked you that?
That's such a good question. You know, we had a long kind of introductory conversation, and I am so reluctant to say, because part of me is like, well, you're the expert on this. You tell me what I should, like, what should we be measuring? What is something that is a marker for high quality inclusion that would help us know, like, what does it really look like? Okay, yeah, we're saying it's that most kids have access to an inclusive program. But part of me is like, if we could hold up a mirror to these programs and they saw that it's, that inclusion is maybe defined like this, but high quality inclusion actually looks like this, and they're somewhere, you know, between these two places, that they might be motivated themselves to do something different. And so it's like, what is that thing that if they were seeing it themselves compared to high quality inclusion, that would motivate them to do things differently? Because with our resources at the state, there's no way we can work with everybody at the intensity that would need to happen for huge systemic change to occur. But I think data and assessment by itself can be an intervention. So what, like, helping them have a desire for even knowing more than just, well, we make placements in inclusive classrooms. And I feel like they think they're done. They met the bar. How was that for not answering your question? I'm like, oh.
How about this? If you were writing the Heidi high quality classroom fidelity tool, and you get to the section about practitioner or classroom attitudes, beliefs, what might be some indicators of, you know, of being rather than doing, the being of the teachers, the practitioners?
Like, what are some of those criteria or indicators that would, okay.
Yeah, maybe you compliment programs on them or brag about them when you see it.
Well, they are values. They are attitude and beliefs that drive, I think, how people actually show up in their work with the child and the family. So it has to do with a sense of belonging, I guess, in terms of believing that children, not just, you know, maybe deserve to be included, but that their purpose is around making that happen. So it's not just like, it goes beyond, I'm going to go in and work with this kiddo on achieving this particular IEP goal. It's really more about having a philosophy of inclusion. And, you know, maybe it's like even the word inclusion, I'm not a big fan of it. But belonging to me means more, because you can say, oh, I'm in an inclusive classroom. And I think people are like, oh, we check that box. When you talk about does each child have a sense of belonging in the program that they're in? How do we as professionals, no matter what our role is, as a program administrator, a district administrator, a service provider, ensure that each child is getting everything they can out of that program? I mean, frankly, whether they have an IEP or not. And I guess maybe a lot of it in my mind has to do with the collaborative nature of those who are working together on behalf of a particular child. So kind of these teaming aspects of providers work together, and the notion that I think I shared with you last week when we met, I had been to this session at the Education Commission of the States meeting that I just like happened into in the last 10 minutes or something. And one of the speakers was describing these two different kind of images. And one was the tape that goes across the finish line of a marathon. And the other was like an image of a team, a rowing team together in the boat. And they just, you know, having them describe those two things together for me, it was like, I feel like a lot of the people that are working in our system are in this image of themselves in their own race. Yes, it's a marathon. It takes a lot of endurance and training, but they're crossing that finish line kind of on their own, by themselves. They might have a sense of purpose. office, but if it's not in harmony and concert with the other people that are around them working on behalf of a particular child and family, then it falls a little flat for me. So, you know, I think part of it is really about getting folks working in harmony. When I think of a lot of people in our system, are working either in general ed or in special ed, and there's not this cohesion between these systems. In some of our districts, it's like they don't even think of themselves on the same team.
Heidi, we might have time for one more question, okay. Or you can talk or you can reflect. What would your preference be?
I don't want to talk anymore.
All right. Take one more question.
Sure.
Okay. If anyone has one, go for it.
How do you think you would measure that sense of belonging that you were describing?
You know, that's such a great question, but I honestly, I don't have an idea about that. Like, I'd love it if kids themselves had some way to contribute to understanding what their sense of belonging is in a classroom environment. I guess, you know, some of that you can get from observing, but I don't, and maybe families help convey that on behalf of their children. That also has to do with how much do they feel they belong in that program. But understanding maybe more like how could it be observed even among a group of children or in a classroom? And I think how much more any one of us contributes to anything when we feel like we belong, we have a purpose.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Heidi. I so wish you guys didn't have real jobs and we could just do these all day longer together. Let's take just like 3-ish minutes, stand up, move around, reset, so that we can shift gears to Catherine. So about 3 minutes. Right. Thank you for moving around quickly, guys, and just continue to do what you need to do in terms of chatting, if you need to update me or mute or turn off your cameras, whatever. We're doing just fine. So, Catherine, whenever you're ready.
Okay. My audio has been a little glitchy, so if you're not hearing me, just okay. Let me know.
Okay.
I don't know if you're able to fix it, but I'm missing about every third or fourth sentence other people are saying. So I think the thing I want to talk about today is we're really kind of in the middle of planning for starting up our school year. And one of the things that we're facing, and it's, we've had this in the past, but it feels like it's a little bit more this year, is unfilled teaching positions. And so right now we have about 6 openings and nobody in the interview pool that we probably want to look at. And so I guess one of the ways that we've always been able, I mean, Alaska has teacher shortages in general, probably more than other states might. And I think a lot of the things that are happening politically and both in the school district and in the state aren't helping that. There's less reasons why anybody would want to move here right now. But one of the things we've always had fostered in the past was a really good relationship with our pre-service early childhood program at UAA. And they lost their accreditation this year and closed the program. So we have no new kids coming up with an early childhood degree. And there's no place in the state that they can get one. So we will be looking at running at least probably 5 of those classrooms with a sub for the year. And honestly, it feels like sometimes we're at the point is what we're doing worse than doing nothing at all? Like when we've got classrooms run by people who really don't know what they're doing, sometimes very well-meaning. So certainly I appreciate what they're doing, because I think that's a lot to ask of a sub. But then what are we missing, and what should we be thinking of with teacher recruitment? And because this is going to be a thing, I think. And then also, what can we do in those classrooms where we don't have a certified teacher to make the best of it? Parents are surprisingly patient about it. Like, we don't get a lot of complaints, which always surprises me that our parents don't say more, because they could, and they probably should in a lot of cases. I think it's one thing to have a short-term sub or to have your teacher out with a medical thing or maternity leave, but to have a sub for the whole year, sometimes a couple years in a row, I think is a lot to put kids and families through. And I think it takes a huge toll on the team around that teacher too. If we look at the strain on the related service providers, on the TAs who have to kind of then pick up all the slack or do a lot of extra work that really isn't their job. So as we're moving into having our people come back in a few weeks, what do we do to wrap around those programs and make, what's the best outcome we can have for those for the year, I guess.
So I don't know that I need to paraphrase. I think Catherine was clear about recruitment. Is there anything being missed? This notion of the wraparound for those who may be in these positions or more than likely will be in these positions. And then Catherine, I'll just say, since you have a kind of a twofold question, which could be peeled back into about 8 questions, as people ask you, if you want to shift, please feel free to say, hey, we haven't given you a time to my A or to my B. Your audio is just fine, but if you can't hear us, we can turn off our videos or something like that to try to increase it, but you are fine for us hearing you. Okay. All right, girls, when you're ready.
Hi, Catherine. If families completely understood the situation as you did, what do you think would change?
I think what would happen is those families that did understand would probably voice some concerns, and then those kids would get moved to a different classroom. I don't think anything would happen system-wide. I think it would just be I think there would have to be a lot of collective families voicing concerns together, I guess, for it to matter. And I think sometimes for our parents, they don't, they're new to the system and they don't have much of a comparison yet, unless they've had older kids or kids that have come through before, that they're really, I don't think they realize yet that they have a concern or that they have a valid concern. I think sometimes they don't see that till they're a little bit further along, and then they look back and they're like, hey, that should have been pretty different than it was. But I think sometimes when they're just starting out, it's so new that they really don't hold us to much of a high bar sometimes.
When you observe a classroom with a teacher that's a sub, what are the things you observe that you struggle the most with?
We have a couple subs that are awesome and would make excellent full-time teachers if they wanted to go down that road. But most of the time they don't have an early childhood background of any kind, so they don't have an understanding of child development. So it's a lot of, what I see a lot of is practices you might see in second, third grade kind of being brought down. Not much of an understanding about what instruction should look like. Sitting way too long at circle time, kids being stressed because they're misbehaving or showing it challenging behaviors because they're being asked to do things they shouldn't being asked to do. Practices that you, when you sub in a second grade classroom, don't always work when you sub in preschool. And they're folks, they don't have a teaching degree, they have a college degree, that's the requirement to be a long-term, but they don't have any education experience, usually. We have a couple that are really close to being able to finish their teaching credentials, and those folks are great. But they also get scooped up really fast. And they're not always available for our programs when we need them. And then there's also the question of, I just cringe when I look at the IEP data that we enter in those classrooms because it's so legally indefensible.
Catherine, if you were doing like a public service announcement campaign, what would be your target audience and what would be your like two or three talking points on that public service campaign or public awareness campaign?
No, that's a good question. I was in a conversation with somebody yesterday and they were talking about how fun it would be to be a recruiter. And I said, I'd be a terrible recruiter because I wouldn't encourage anybody to come work with us right now. So I'm not sure I'm the best one to come up with that campaign speech. But I think our target audience is, we tend to get a lot of younger teachers in Alaska that are coming up from the lower 48 that kind of just want to have a sense of adventure. You know, they want to see something new, try something new. Go somewhere cool for a little while. They don't usually stay unless they meet somebody and get married and have a family. Like, that's how we get people to stay. They don't usually stay. Most of our folks don't last 5 years. And so that's a big money drain, but at least they're here when they're here. I'm really worried with not being able to grow any of our local talent without having a program in state right now, what that's going to do in the next 2 or 3 years, like what that's going to, I think that shortage is going to become a lot bigger pretty soon. And then it will be us taking which we do anyway, but taking folks who went through an elementary program and putting them pretty, you know, like right now, I'd say about half of our new hires came from an early childhood program and about half came from elementary. But I think it's going to be, everyone's going to come from a K-12 program or a K-6 program if they can't do something to get that program in state. So I guess the talking points, but back to the question. Yeah, I don't know. People do come here. Like, it surprises me that they continue. We used to have a pretty good retirement system and fairly decent salary, you know, but we don't anymore. But people still, I'm surprised we get as many applicants as we do. We get a lot of military people. Military families come up. And so, again, they don't stay very long, but sometimes that can bring up some pretty experienced people.
When you think of those subs, Catherine, that are being somewhat successful or relatively successful, you know, what conditions are in that classroom, or what did that sub learn quickly or have support in that made them more successful than others?
I think if they're working with a good team at the school. So if they're like, we have some buildings where we might have three or four preschools, and if three out of four are certified and strong, that usually goes better because they've got good partnerships. They can collaborate with each other. There's a lot of assistance with lesson planning and sharing kids and things like that. So I've seen it be okay in a few of our buildings where most of it was really solid. Places where there's only one preschool and it's a sub is hard because there's nobody to learn from. There's nobody to go and observe or to partner with, I think. I wish we had the flexibility to move the openings around a little bit to kind of put them where they'd have the least impact. Because right now I think four of them are in solo sites where they don't have a good team. I'd like to be able to move them so they could be like to some of our stronger sites, have them have one sub position, and then I think the impact would be less. And I think we need to start exploring some kind of relationship with either like Oregon or Washington or something with, you know, some pre-service programs to try to make some connections and have some internship opportunities for students in hopes that because a lot of our young adults we were getting from UAA would do internships, would do student teaching in our classrooms, and then we would hire them immediately, like they would just stay, right? And that was a really nice way to make sure folks were a good fit. And so I think we need to come up with some kind of connection to some kind of, and I think it has to be at a state for this year, program where we're kind of growing our talent.
I was going to ask, can you identify three or four people in your system who are allies on this issue? Or champions of these same kinds of, you know, outcomes that you're talking about?
Current allies? No. I know that, like, Matsu, which is the second biggest school district in Alaska has similar. They have, they're the only other program that really runs a big kind of preschool program. But they do have, they have challenges filling their positions as well. So I know that there's similar concerns. I feel like we had some strong allies in the, at the UAA early childhood program. We had a really good network and a really strong working relationship before they, and their program was forced to close kind of suddenly and unexpectedly. So I feel like we lost a lot of our friends when that happened. The state doesn't really seem to mind what's going on. They're not concerned. Our State Department's really small. And so it's not like it's a big influencing organization, but they don't have much, they don't have anything to say about it. So, and I think that the stance of the district leadership is it's the state's responsibility to provide us with enough candidates. And if they're not doing their job, then we don't have to, this is the best we'll do kind of thing. I also think there's a lot still in of upper leadership that it's just preschool, right? So how bad is it if you have a sub kind of thinking? Like, I don't think we're not really past that. So I think any efforts that we make will have to be just our little team. I don't think any special ed in general has trouble recruiting teachers. So it's not, and they do have, we do have some programs, like we have the GETS program, the general to special education. So we can hire gen ed teachers in our special education classrooms and we pay for them to get their master's degree. And we give them support of a supervising teacher for 3 years, you know, so we do have some incentives. We can't even get GETS people right now, so. We used to offer a signing bonus, which was helpful and got people, it means people could afford to move here that were young and didn't have a lot of money. And that was something that I think when they took that away, I think that in some ways reduced our applicants. But that can make a difference for someone who has to drive up or move, you know, like just the cost of moving here is a little expensive.
What would the other professionals that are working around these substitutes, like those wrap, you know, you mentioned the wraparound, what would they say they need in order to make this work?
I think they would say they need probably more time and lower caseloads, which does happen some places. You know, just by the nature of who lives in that neighborhood at the time, sometimes like the load of the SLP or the, you know, sometimes the special ed teacher at the building might be a little bit lighter. And so they do have some extra time to kind of really help kind of grow that substitute up a little bit.
There were a couple of practices you could implement or institute for these new staff who might not have the credentials. What might those couple of things be within the first couple months of them being in the classroom?
I'd really like to get them some training quickly, just like a overview of at least the curriculum, an overview of the kids that they're working with. I wish there was a way to partner them with somebody to have some kind of mentorship opportunity. Unfortunately, since they're subs, they're not even allowed to come to trainings because they don't get paid for training days, which is ridiculous. But some way to kind of be able to pay existing teachers somehow to kind of adopt them, to partner with them, just to give them enough tools to, you know, really make it so they can, because I think when we pick up the subs at the beginning of the year, their hope is that there's not going to be a full year commitment, but in reality, it usually, if they start with a sub, they're probably going to be there all year. We don't have much luck filling positions mid-year. So I'd love to see some sort of, like, we have a mentorship program for first year teachers, and I'd like to see that offered to subs as well, because I think that's even probably a bigger need. And at least to have them be able to participate in our professional development and training that we do for everybody, like if they could be a part of that. And we've had a few subs who come unpaid to our training days, and that always blows me away that they're, you know, that dedicated and willing to do that, because it, you know, there's certainly nobody expected them to. But it's hard to get them, I guess, time for to get that training.
I'm kind of going back to the recruitment side of it. You mentioned the State Department doesn't really take notice or react much. Who else outside of the government, agencies, private organizations might benefit from high quality preschools in your area or might take notice?
We have a local organization that supports most of our non-school district early learning programs. And they've made some moves in the last couple of years to kind of the seed, I don't know if that's a national thing, the Learning Grow. It's like a registry where folks, they kind of set some, they're trying to get a system in place where they set like some indicators for quality. It's not in action yet. They're just kind of starting it. It's taken a while to get off the ground. So I know that's something that agency, that's a lot of their work is promoting high quality programs for they don't really do much with the school district. It's mostly the non-school district, private centers and places like that. We partner a lot with Head Start. And I know that's something that they also struggle with is finding teachers. The school district has been more successful because we have a better salary, Start does. But I'd say right now we're probably in the same boat that they are with not having a lot of qualified applicants.
Catherine, we have probably time for at least one more question if you'd like it, or if you'd like to process or reflect. Do you have a preference?
Yeah, if someone has a question, that's good.
All right.
Not, I'm writing down a few ideas, so.
Sorry, I always feel like sometimes when I offer that, it disrupts the flow a bit. So I'll just wait another few seconds in case something comes to people's minds. If not, we'll shift gears. All right, if something comes to mind or you were a little worried that it might be a long answer and so you didn't ask it, feel free to drop it in the chat. It'll get recorded and is something I can put in my notes and share with Catherine after the fact as well. So let's take 5 minutes, stand up, move around again, and then we'll shift over to Jody. Sorry, I forgot to start my timer, so I hope that wasn't too short or too long. It felt like five-ish, and plus time is just going so flipping fast. So as people come back, we're going to shift gears over to Jody, and then remember, we won't have time for action planning as a group, but I'll invite each of you, if you have to jump off, to take a few minutes to organize your thoughts and your action steps and then share them in Facebook or share them with me just so that you have a record of all your action steps since the beginning. I'll also be able to stay on if people want to talk about or answer any questions about session 6, which is, again, blink in a couple of days. And we'll go from there. But I don't want to take up any more time for hot seats. So Jody, whenever you're ready.
Okay. Well, I have two options to talk about. Maybe there's some commonalities between the two. I think I'm going to choose the birth to three option to talk about. In Minnesota, just a reminder of our innovation work that we do a little bit, we have three different innovations. Two of them are classroom innovations for kind of that Part B world pyramid model. We work with Dr. Strain and National Pyramid Model folks around that one. And then classroom engagement, also with Dr. Strain and a couple others. And then we have our family guided routines based intervention innovation in the birth to three world. And that's our newest innovation. I'm entering year three of this job, and I have two teams who are doing that innovation right now. And when I say doing that innovation, it means they applied for a five-year, it's not a grant, but agreement, a JPA agreement, and we provide financial support and then external coaching, and I'm the external coach for the two teams. We also have content leads for each of our innovations. So we have a professional development facilitator who's the content lead for FGRBI. And then, of course, we have the person at Minnesota Department of Ed who's in charge of all of us. We just had a meeting, and there's this panic happening in that our lead at Minnesota Department of Ed said that that the team there pulled all of the child outcome summary data for innovation teams and looked at it, and they were thrilled with the results for pyramid model and classroom engagement model. The outcomes for children went up in programs who were implementing those innovations, but in FGRBI, the outcomes went down. And so she's really looking at changing a lot of the way that the innovation is rolled out to teams. And I think there's some fear with some of my other team members that maybe she'll pull the plug on the innovation altogether if we can't fix this. So there's a sense of urgency, which, you know, as I talked through last time, I don't do well with urgency. I need time to read, reflect, ponder, pontificate. So I'm like, I want to offer things and get in on the conversations, but it's a little overwhelming right now. I was asked by Lisa, who's our MDE person, to support one of the changes she'd like to make is moving towards requiring teams who are doing FGRBI innovation work to move to a transdisciplinary model or primary service provider model. And so she's asked me to think about how we can message this to teams without causing a great deal of upset, and how we can support teams from a systems perspective as well, not just a practice level. So I want to do a really good job with this. But you know, she wants me to have some answers Friday. and again, there's this sense of urgency. I mean, I have an opportunity to influence a little bit. Lisa is a great listener. She I appreciate that she's asking for input from the team. So I guess I'm just thinking about how to best prepare for my conversations with her without getting analysis paralysis. And then also, I'm a little worried in that she did mention that she wants to look at primary service provider model, but she doesn't know that she wants to call it that. Because teams get a little bit nervous about that term, and is what she said. And also, I think she doesn't agree with necessarily all of the expert model pieces of it, such as, I mean, the one that she has the hardest time with is that in order to do PSP, anybody needs to be able to be a PSP. In Minnesota, because we are, school districts also do the birth to three, many of our related service providers are birth to 21. They cover the whole age range. And so she just doesn't see how we could have an OTB, a related or a PSP in that case. So, and that worries me a little bit on many different levels. Anyway, I guess my question is, how do I best prepare for this and avoid getting in this rut of wanting the perfect decision versus an iteration and then plan, do, study, act, and move forward?
Quick side note, girls, as you're thinking about your questions, as always, when there's something that is so related to all of your work and you may have ideas and suggestions and or you want to know other people's answers, keep a side note of those too. So if you have resources, recommendations, you know Jody loves to dig deep and to explore and to read. So I'm sure she would welcome all of that. So just keep that running note as you invite her to explore her shark music and explore what she's already said she wants, which is not to get in her old traps. And then I guess also remember, don't ask questions that are about satisfying your own curiosity. If there are more things about how Minnesota operates or why Lisa feels the way she does or any of that stuff, make sure that you shape it so that it's a question you couldn't possibly know the answer or that Jody doesn't already know the answer to.
Jody, what's your hunch about what's happening with the Coast scores?
Honestly, my hunch is that we still have practitioners who don't know how to do valid Coast ratings. So I do wonder if we're not dealing with some dirty data anyway, and that we're making some really big jumps based on data that might not be real solid. And that came up at the meeting where there were 13 of us and Lisa, you know, when she shared that that was the reason that these conversations were happening. Someone else on the team asked about how valid do we feel the data is, and Lisa, I feel bad. Somebody probably knows Lisa. Christy, I know you know Lisa.
It's okay. It's all safe.
She's so uber smart, but she also is known to be a little bit of a Pollyanna view about what's actually happening out in the field. And the 13 of us are the ones that actually see what's happening out in the field. And so I think she is making assumptions that practitioners are much better at making valid ratings than they are. And so that was hard for her to hear when we questioned, and she's just at a place where she really needs to believe we're getting good data. Mm. But yeah, I do question the validity of that data. That being said, though, I agree that there are things that need to change just from other data that we've been getting. We collect data from so we provide 5 days of content training for FGRBI for the teams that are in the innovation. And then we survey the teams after the trainings. And compared to our other innovations, the feedback we're getting about the trainings themselves is not very good. So that's a red flag to me. To me, that's more valid than the child outcome summary data, knowing that we're missing the mark in our trainings somehow. She's really focused on the outcome data. And I know it's coming from OSEP and the feds. That happens.
Go ahead, please.
Let's say that we fast forward 12 months and you go ahead and engage in this opportunity. In an ideal world, what's one or two things that would be different next year as a result of the work that you engaged in over the next 12 months?
I think in relation to the primary service provider piece, I think what would be different is that we support teams in the why behind it so that we have some true buy-in, and then have a scaffolded way of moving from, I would say most of our teams are doing more what I would call a multidisciplinary model. So we would have a scaffolded kind of benchmarks of quality system-wise to help move towards that primary service provider model. And then we would also integrate specific practices into our trainings, which we don't really touch PSP in our trainings right now at all. So we would really do some thinking about what skills need to be taught in the practitioner level content trainings that we're providing to help them feel confident in doing PSP. So kind of a systems, we'd have more of a benchmark, gradual, you don't need to change it from today to tomorrow kind of a thing. Because again, messaging-wise, I think that would send some of our teams into a tailspin, especially since we didn't message it that way for them to sign up for the 5-year innovation. I think had we said for some of them that, oh yeah, you're going to need to do PSP, that might have been a deal breaker, and they wouldn't have even, it would have been scary enough that they wouldn't have moved forward with it. So I think we need to be careful in our expectations and the pacing. And I think Lisa wants to kind of make it happen tomorrow.
Jill, if you could design the outcome of your meeting, whenever this meeting is with Lisa, what is the best outcome that you could imagine from that meeting?
I think the best outcome would be, number one, if I felt like she was slowing down a little bit. She seemed to be really revved up, is that the right word, last time, and a little bit panicked. So I think that if I could some way support her in feeling like she has the space to really think before acting kind of a thing. But and then I think the other outcome would be having a conversation about evidence-based practices and you know, if she wants to change the name of PSP to, gosh, what was her, relationship-based, I can't remember, but to her the key is that, you know, the primary service provider is building this relationship with the family, and that's going to drive the rest of the intervention. And I'm a little concerned because teams that are looking at doing PSP MSP often turn to Robin McWilliams or Russian Sheldon or the agreed upon practices, some of those things, to really look at, you know, what the criteria, what the critical elements of PSP are based on the research. And I get concerned, and that's a thing with me. I'm like, am I being crazy and being too much? Am I not doing the and both here? As far as the actual sticking to the intervention as an evidence-based practice and not Minnesotatizing it too much or watering it down or drifting from what actually made it research-based. So I feel like I don't know that my outcome is to change her mind, but I would like to just make sure that we're having that conversation so she's thinking through it and is clear on, at least if she is going to change the criteria, we need to communicate very clearly what fidelity will look like in her mind if they're doing that model. That was a really long answer.
What do you think the Department of Ed is most afraid of? What has gotten them in this panic mode? I mean, the data got them there, but what are they afraid of?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting you ask that because I don't know about the department as a whole, but and maybe it does stand true, but for Lisa herself, I think she's considering retirement. And these innovations have been her work, her legacy, she's really worked hard, but she's using our discretionary dollars to do this. And I think she feels like if we can't show that there's success, you know, through the child outcome data, that kind of thing, that the person who comes in and takes her place may decide that these innovations aren't the best way to spend these discretionary dollars and it might go by the wayside. And so I think that might be where her fear and her sense of urgency is coming from. So I'm trying to be really empathetic about that because I get that. It's her legacy and thank goodness. I mean, it's what's giving me a job right now, for gosh sakes. So, but I do think that that's her fear. Maybe the rest of the department is a little bit fearful that if we go in and change too much, it's going to be that usual mantra of, oh, the pendulum's swinging again. Here we go. They're changing things on us again. And so that's where I'm really trying to, because I've been with the people holding the torches against the state, I've been there. I know that if we really focus on the practices aren't changing, we're just changing the way that we're packaging it, providing the training, that sort of thing. But it's not like we're saying, oh, here's a whole new set of practices. So I really want that message to come across loud and clear. I think it's important that that's not changing.
When you've implemented you mentioned these other models or evidence-based practices or innovations, what has conversation looked like around those if there was a desire to alter them in some way?
Or think that with those, the data sources we used were different. We've made minor changes along the way to those, to classroom engagement model and pyramid model. And so typically the changes we made were based on feedback from trainings, or we would look at, we collect benchmarks of quality data on implementation teams. And so we would look at that and realize, oh, teams are struggling with, you know, a tier three procedure. Let's call Dr. Strain and have him do some TA around prevent, teach, reinforce, you know? So I think that we looked at the data differently. And I also think that for those innovations, we have a national level to kind of go to. FGRBI, we feel like, I mean, we're using the key indicators as our fidelity tool. It's just a little bit squishier in general. And that's the other thing that, you know, a suggestion from the team was maybe we need to bring in Julianne Woods, Robin McWilliams, somebody for a little bit more TA to help us get through some of this. But Lisa, I think, really wants to keep it more the agreed upon principles, practices, you know, that melding of those, all those different experts kind of, although we call it FGRBI, which is Julianne's work. So it's, I think the other work, just the parameters are a little bit more clear, even from a national TA level. So when those changes happen, like right now with pyramid model, we're bringing in all the equity work and everything. Well, that's because the national folks are starting it and we're just adopting it then into what we're doing. So we don't have that same luxury. And from what I hear, Julianne might be retiring or is retiring too. So she did provide a little TA to us over the past couple of years.
Jody, if you had to guess why Lisa, or what are two or three characteristics that you bring as a professional that Lisa would be relying on in asking for your help with this?
Well, I think she appreciates that I do my homework, and that I was in the field relatively recently. She worked with me. I called on her a lot when I was just a practitioner. I shouldn't say it that way, but when I was a practitioner, and she's been kind of recruiting me to get into more of a state position. So this was my compromise, taking this current position. So I think she appreciates that I do my homework and that I have a pulse on kind of what's really happening, although she doesn't always want to hear it. And she'll just tell me, she'll cover her ears, blah, 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 don't tell me. I'm trying to think of what, I totally burst her bubble the other day when I told her that teams were still making decisions about how many joint visits to do based on how a kid did on the evaluation. Oh, minus 1.5 on the Bailey. They get, you know, 8 joint visits from the SLP versus having those conversations about primary service provider and how much support that person needs. So I would say those are two things. And then, I think she trusts me, to be honest with her in general. I think there's a level of trust there as well. But I feel my Minnesota nice kicking in, knowing that, I mean, not Minnesota nice, but I'm feeling a little protective of her right now, I think, because I know she's really struggling emotionally, and like, she just can't, she can't decide when she's actually retiring. I mean, she's been talking about it forever. And she likes to give me a hard time and say, if I would just take her job, she'd retire. But I don't want her job. No way. So maybe there's a level of guilt there, too. I'm feeling bad because I think she'd be gone if she knew that she had a person she was comfortable with ready to step in for her. So that might be something that I'm considering as I chat with her.
Go there a little bit more, Jody, because you already brought up both and. Can you think of three ways that the end result would be there's a little bit more stability to this innovation? Other than Jody taking the job, what are three other things that would give a sense of stability?
I think Lisa and MDE need to really go back to maybe defining what they want the outcomes of the innovation to be. It started where we just started, our content trainings start at high quality, the actual home visit. We don't talk about anything leading up to the home visit. So we don't talk about intake, referral intake, evaluation, writing, you know, high quality, functional outcomes. We're making a huge assumption that teams who come into the innovation already know that. And I think that maybe that we're seeing is not necessarily the case. So either we need to do more in setting the stage and exploration and supporting teams to get ready for the innovation and making sure they have that foundational knowledge in place, or we need to add it to our training somehow. So I think that would stabilize it a little bit. Maybe the whole idea of her having a different version of PSP would work. I don't know. I guess I need to hear more from her about what her vision is of that. And also I think that for whatever reason, I think we might need to change the way we do. So we have a very formal exploration process that leads up to teams applying for these innovations. And we kind of do it a uniform way across all three innovations. But my gut is that FGRBI, moving from a child deficit model to doing more of a family-centered way of doing things, that's such a seismic change in attitudes, beliefs. You know, pyramid model, they might be doing some of those things already in their classroom, so it's not this huge jump. And FGRBI just feels so much bigger. And so I think by treating it exactly the same way as we are with the Part B innovations, we're looking for uniformity a little bit and standardization. But I wonder, does it have to be that way? So that would maybe be an and both, that exploration is going to look a little bit different for FGRBI than it does for pyramid model and classroom engagement model. It's that paradox of we want standardization, yet we want to be able to individualize, right? So where can we give a little?
We probably have time for one more question, Jody, or if you want to reflect out what you say.
I just reflective supervision just kind of popped into my head of,
okay,
you know, where I think that because the size of the change and the amount of change that's involved in FGRPI, I feel like we need to support practitioners at more of that emotional level of some of that. And so I know that some of our programs do take part in reflective supervision and consultation on their own. And I'm just wondering, I'd kind of like to look at the data of some of those teams compared to others. It would be an interesting data dig to see if they're maybe getting to fidelity on the key indicators a little bit more quickly than others or not.
Okay. So many questions, so many world changes, girls, in so little time. So thank you, Jody. And again, if anybody has things you want to jump in right now and say, because you just don't want to forget, go for it. Otherwise, make sure that you connect with each other outside of our time, or use our Facebook, or use me to share and give to others. So normally we would go into action planning and gifts of gratitude, but I'd like to use our last 3 minutes for those who have to jump off. If there's any question about session number 6, or just anything in general that you need to be selfish, get your needs met, and then if you can stay on longer. Want me to restate anything, paraphrase, redirect? All right, Heidi, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank your children for us too.
I think, Christy, for me, I do have to go. My flight is actually lining up. The timing ended up working out. I was nervous. But I have not watched. I think you posted a little podcast, but I haven't watched it. So I might have to reach out with some questions after I hop off.
Totally fine.
Because I don't know what to expect for 6. So.
That's fine. Jump off, Susan. It should all be in there. And I try to take your brains and make it simpler. But it's to use Ted. I used his analogy of a talk story. It's shooting the breeze. So literally you have about 20 minutes to shoot the breeze. So if that helps alleviate anybody's anxiety about a full-on performance, you're just having a conversation about your journey. There's a bit of work about a pledge, but it doesn't even have to be done by when we meet. It could be later. All you need to be ready for on Friday is your talk story, just to share your mastermind journey. Okay, so jump off as you need to, but if that helps anybody, even if you do listen to my recording and you don't believe me, I'll say it again. It's literally just for you to share your journey, and you won't have many hours to reflect between now and Friday what your journey means to you, but it's this idea of what has this journey meant to you, and more importantly, what does it mean for you as a going forward leader in our field? But it's not a hot seat, and it's not, there aren't any rules. And that sort of thing. You guys are terribly busy, so you probably have not listened to my recording that's posted on Facebook. So I'll just clarify really quickly. There's 2 pieces of homework. Normally we have about 2-3 weeks between session 5 and 6 for you to do the homework. We have a couple of nights. So the first part is a pledge, and there's a whole backstory from my friend Jonathan Fields about it. It's about how to succeed, and so you might want to take time away, you know, next week, a month from now, hopefully not too much longer than that, to like listen to it and really think about your pledge. But I try to give you an example of what it means, but it's the accountability part of the mastermind. It's your pledge going forward that I can then continue to support you, but that does not have to be ready by Friday. If it is, great, check it off your to-do list. If it isn't, put it on your list of things to do. The thing for Friday is literally just every one of you having a chunk of sacred time for you to share your story. Some people do a PowerPoint. I gave you an example of what Hattie Harvey, it's a colleague of Catherine and mine's from Alaska. She did this little animation thing. I just wanted to show you that to be creative, not to make you feel like you have to create anything. Some people just reflect and then talk. Some people look back at their goals and go, wow, I had no idea what to expect. And this is what the mastermind process has meant to me. And this is what I want to be as a leader going forward. One person had a PowerPoint her first session when she introduced herself. So she did like an analysis of that PowerPoint and what the colors meant and the imagery that she used at the beginning of her mastermind. And then she redid her introduction of herself now that she's clear. So she changed her color palette and her image and her words that she used to describe herself. So basically in the beginning, it was a lot of squiggles and I'm a hot mess and I have no idea who I am or where I'm going. I have all these passions, I'm multi-passionate. And then in the end, she had this very straightforward, this is my purpose, this is my passion, this is what I'm gonna do. So she used that as her pre-post. I don't know if that helps or makes it worse, but it's literally just a chat, okay? All right, Catherine and I are going to stay on for a minute to solve the problems of Alaska. Anybody that wants to stay on and help me, it's a big state, you're welcome to. If not, you're welcome to jump off and ask anything you need to in between now and when I see you Friday. And I'll keep typing up notes as fast as I can. Okay. Bye, guys. I'm going to stop.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Dana. Sorry for your shark music of getting on earlier, but you're just...
no worries. It was just a little technical difficulty.
I know. And I'm glad things went well with Will. So we'll talk later.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Have a good day.
Okay, bye.